At this time, I'll go ahead and ask our presenter, Kevin, to go ahead and call up the presentation materials. And as I'm doing that, I'm going to put your two speakers here into the spotlight view so that they can introduce themselves and get started with today's training. The first speaker I'd like to turn the floor over to is Patricia Overmeyer. Patricia?
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. My name is Patricia Overmeyer. I am the Deputy Director of EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, and I also served as EPA's designated federal official during the development of the All Appropriate Inquiries Regulation.
Great. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Kevin Pelayo with ICF. I'm a licensed professional geologist with over 25 years of experience on site assessment, remediation, and sustainable revitalization programs at brownfield, Superfund, and state waste sites. I've supported EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization for nearly 20 years across a range of activities, including managing direct technical assistance to communities, delivering comprehensive training on various topics, as well as supporting EPA's Repowering America's Land initiative. Happy to be here today.
Okay, I think we're ready to get started. Kevin, you're moving the slides, correct? Okay, everyone, just a little outline of what we're going to be talking about today. First of all, I'll give you a little bit of background on CERCLA, the Superfund law, and the liability provisions there and why we came to have all appropriate inquiries and what it means. And module two will then go through on a very high level scale what the requirements are, the regulatory requirements for all appropriate inquiries. Then I will turn it over to Kevin Pelayo, who will talk about the more and more specifically, like what are the activities that you actually have to do in order to comply with the AAI requirements. And then after that, Kevin will also go through some of the reporting requirements that everyone needs to comply with in order to document that, in fact, you are in compliance with the regulation.
All right, Patricia, I think I'm here to step in for a quick audience poll, if that's okay with you. So there are actually going to be two questions that are going to pop up on the screen. I'm going to hit the launch button right now, and I'll just read off the first question. And then, Kevin, I'll have you move to the next question. If for any reason you cannot see the pop-up poll window on your screen, you'll see the questions on the slides, and you can merely type your response into the Q&A window. So our first question is asking, how many years of experience do you have in brownfields assessment, cleanup, and redevelopment? And you'll see options to pick from less than 2 years, 2 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years, or 10 to 20 years. And I will let you know if you have more than 20 years, you can go ahead and pick that last option as well. If you can, Kevin, go ahead and move to the next question because the second question that should appear is asking if you can describe your level of experience with phase one ESA and AAI assessments. Do you have no experience, reviewed phase one reports? Have you conducted phase one activities or have you overseen and managed these projects? So simply check the circle next to the answers that most closely match your responses for those two questions and hit the submit button. Again, if you can't see the poll windows, please don't worry. You won't be graded on your responses. You can simply send in a quick message responding generally to those questions in the Q&A as well. So with that, it does look like we've got about 81% of you having shared your responses. So I'm going to close those polls now and let's take a look at the results. So it looks like about 43% of the audience is relatively new to our topic, with less than 2 years of experience in brownfields assessment, cleanup, and redevelopment. But we do have a number of participants with a range of anywhere from 2 to 20 or more years. And then when looking at this second question, almost half of you have at least reviewed phase one ESA and AAI reports. And about a quarter of you have overseen these projects, but 20% of the audience have absolutely no experience with the topic. So with that background on the audience, I want to thank you all for participating, and I'll turn it back to you, Patricia.
Thanks, Jean. Okay, so what is all appropriate inquiries? Most of you probably know, but just for everyone's introduction, all appropriate inquiries is the process of evaluating a property's environmental conditions and assessing potential liability for the contamination that may be there. Basically, this is a phase one environmental site assessment. Most of you probably know it as that. We call it a phase one. It is what most of you may know as an ASTM E1527 phase one environmental site assessment. It's also a very necessary step for figuring out not just what the environmental contamination is at the site, but who may be potentially liable for the previous contamination, a very important step when anyone is acquiring a piece of commercial property. So just to put a little bit in perspective, again, AI is usually the first step. It's the phase one, but not the final step in doing any kind of inquiry into the assessment of a piece of commercial property. It's part of a continuum that you want to do when acquiring a piece of property, after you've acquired a piece of property, because you want to know what are the environmental conditions there and what are you getting yourself into when you obtain a piece of property. So this is the phase one, the first step. But after you do a phase one, if there's any indication that there's environmental contamination at the site, you're going to want to do a phase two. You may need to do sampling and analysis. And even after that, there may be some additional site characterization that you want to do so you thoroughly understand what the environmental conditions are at the property so that you know what you need to do in the form of cleaning up that property and making sure that it's ready for its reuse or revitalization. So whatever that reuse or revitalization is, it's protective of human health and the environment. So many of you may be brownfields grantees, or you may be working for a brownfields grantees if you're an environmental contractor. So it's important to understand how all appropriate inquiries affects brownfields grantees. Basically, the statute, the Superfund CERCLA statute, which gives EPA the authorization to provide brownfields grants to grantees, has certain conditions on what our grantees can do with their funding once they have our funding. And one of those conditions is a prohibition against using any brownfields grant monies to address contamination for which the grantee may be held potentially responsible. So, if the grantee is potentially responsible for the contamination at the property, they cannot use brownfields grant funding to address that contamination. So, in effect, when folks apply for a brownfields grant or get a brownfields grant, that potential grantee needs to demonstrate to EPA that you are not the responsible party. And in order to make that demonstration, in many cases, you're going to have to do all appropriate inquiry in order to demonstrate you're not responsible for the contamination. You're not a liable party. Also, recipients of brownfields assessment grants, the statute requires that when you get a brownfields assessment grant, you do a phase one with our funding. You have to do that phase one environmental site assessment in compliance with the all appropriate inquiries requirements. There again, with liability determinations, with most of the liability determinations that are afforded brownfields grantees and other parties under CERCLA, in order to meet and demonstrate that you're in compliance with the liability protections, you have to do all appropriate inquiries as a first step prior to acquiring the property. Also, if you are the recipient of a targeted brownfield assessment, these are assessments that EPA does, there are contractors do on the behalf of a community, we will do those targeted brownfields assessment in compliance with the all appropriate inquiries requirements. So a little bit of just objectives of this training. You are not going to get trained in order to go out and do environmental site assessment today. Basically, this training is to familiarize you with the requirements of the regulation of all appropriate inquiries, to provide an overview of how all appropriate inquiries applies to our brownfields grantees, and then provide an interview of the technical requirements that one needs to do in order to be compliant with the AI or phase one environmental site assessment, and what the good practice in the industry is. And then also, very importantly, we want to review the AAI reporting requirements, because each of our grantees needs to document that the all appropriate inquiry was done. It was done in compliance with the AAI rule. And so we will go over, Kevin, later we'll go over on the reporting requirements that are required in order to show that documentation. So on to module one, just a little bit of background on CERCLA liability. So basically, CERCLA, the Superfund legislation, has been on the books since 1980. CERCLA is the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. So in 1980, things were pretty bad. We had a lot of seriously contaminated sites in the US, and Congress's objective then was to figure out who was liable, who needed to be, who was liable or responsible, and who had to be compensated for the damages, and also who had to pay or who had to provide the compensation for the environmental effects that happened. So prior to 2002, this is 1980 until about 2000, until 2002, property owners could be held what we say as stripped and jointly and severally liable for contamination of the property. Basically, the Superfund law of 1980, CERCLA, required that a liability be assigned, and liability can be assigned a strict liability, which means without fault or culpability. If a person was in the ownership chain of a piece of property and waste were managed, hazardous substances were managed at that site while you or they owned the property, they could be held strictly liable without fault or culpability. Also, joint and severally, which means that current and past owners could be held accountable individually or collectively. So any owner within the property's chain of title could be held liable for contamination of the property, regardless of whether any particular owner caused the contamination. So this is pretty restrictive, and it's pretty strict, but basically ownership meant you could be held liable for any contamination that was there. Next slide, please. Well, I think Congress and others realized pretty quickly that this strict joint and several liability scheme was perhaps too strict, and that it really put a damper on people wanting to purchase property that was used or managed by someone in the past, because if there was contamination, the property that anybody within the chain of ownership could be held responsible for the contamination. So Congress, beginning in 1986, tried to make some amendments to CERCLA in order to reduce the or alleviate some of the strictness of the liability, let's say. So basically, 1986 amendments to CERCLA, Congress provided what we call the innocent landowner provision. This is the innocent landowner defense. Basically, in 1986, Congress said that parties can claim a defense to liability if they can demonstrate that they did not know and they had no reason to know of contamination at the site at the time they acquired the property. Congress went on to say that parties had to conduct all appropriate inquiries prior to property acquisition to determine past uses and past ownership. But then the catch was that then, once you did all appropriate inquiry, if you had reason to believe the property could be contaminated, then you lost your defense. So basically, it was kind of quirky, and it didn't allow for a lot of runarounds to strict joint and several liability, because the do you had no reason to know, you did not know, or had no reason to know, was kind of weird, and that first you had to figure out whether it was contaminated. Once you did, you lost the liability. So it was not a great answer to our liability issues under CERCLA. Next slide, please. So basically, between 1986 and 2002, Congress and EPA heard from a lot of folks, particularly the Conference of Mayors and others, that this strict joint and several liability scheme was really killing the commercial property market, and that sites that wouldn't rise to the level of a Superfund site, they weren't extraordinarily contaminated. There wasn't a high amount of contamination at these sites, or the sites were merely abandoned and weren't contaminated, but they looked as if they would be contaminated. Folks, real estate investors, other property acquirers were staying away from properties that could be contaminated because they were scared to death of the strict joint and civil liability. The Conference of Mayors came to EPA, went to Congress and said, this is killing our inner cities, and that we have these properties. They're probably not extraordinarily contaminated, but they look bad, or they have at least some slight level of contamination. Folks aren't going to acquire these properties. They're not going to clean them up. They're not going to put them back to reuse because of the strict joint and civil liability standards under CERCLA. Congress listened, EPA and others worked with Congress, and we got the 2002 Brownfields Amendments to CERCLA, which basically is a Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act, which amended CERCLA and provided us with several liability protections. That was in 2002. Congress amended the innocent landowner provisions. They added the contiguous property owner provisions, which is basically a codification of EPA's contaminated groundwater policy. And then, most importantly, added the bona fide prospective purchaser provision, which finally allowed folks to purchase property with knowledge of contamination, took away that did not know, had no reason to know provision, and said you could purchase property with the knowledge of contamination under certain conditions. So, and then with all of this, Congress also amended the all appropriate inquiries provisions of CERCLA. In the 1986 amendment, there were only four conditions. With the 2002 amendments to CERCLA, Congress amended the all appropriate inquiries provisions to look a lot like the commercial standard, which was the ASTM E1527-97 provision at the time. So with the amendments, eligible entities would need would need to establish the fence to CERCLA liability to be eligible for site-specific assessment grants and direct cleanup grants. Because remember, into the 2002 amendments also amended CERCLA to provide EPA the authorization to provide brownfields grants. And part of the conditions for brownfields grants, again, were that assessment grants had to be done in compliance with the all appropriate increase provisions, and that grantees could not use their grant money to address contamination for which they were the liable party. And so grantees would need to show that they were not liable, and they would need to use all of the, they would need to use the all appropriate inquiries standard in order to, as a one step in providing that demonstration that they were in compliance with the liability exemption protections. Okay, so the statutory requirements for the CERCLA liability protections. So remember, 2002, we got the innocent landowner provision, contiguous property owner provision, and the bona fide prospective purchaser provision. In all cases, Congress said there were some put in place some threshold conditions. Basically, the person who is purchasing a potentially contaminated property could not be the responsible party and could not be affiliated with the responsible party. So basically, if you were the person who put the contamination there, or you were somehow affiliated with the responsible party, you could not avail yourself of the liability protections. Also, another threshold condition in order to get the liability protections afforded in the 2002 amendments, you had to conduct all appropriate inquiries prior to purchase. The idea here that Congress made very clearly is that you had to know before purchasing what the conditions were at the property. So you had to do the all appropriate inquiry prior to purchasing the property. Also, you had after purchasing the property, you could no longer manage hazardous substances at the property. So basically, all the disposal of the hazardous substances was done before you acquired it. Before you acquired it, you did your all appropriate inquiry. And again, you could not be you could not be a responsible party. Then, after purchasing it, Congress said there were some continuing obligations that had to be complied with after purchase. So basically, before you purchase it, you do all appropriate inquiry. And on the next slide, After purchase, you had to take care of the property. You had to have good stewardship of the property. You had to comply with any land use restrictions, not impede the effectiveness of any institutional controls at the property. You had to take reasonable steps to stop ongoing releases. So if there were ongoing releases, we had leaking tanks, leaking containers. Otherwise, there were releases at the property. You had to take reasonable steps to stop the releases once you were the owner of the property. You had to prevent people from coming onto the property if there were releases or hazardous substances being managed at the property. It would cooperate with EPA if we had to have access to the property and comply with requests for information and subpoenas. So all appropriate inquiry prior to purchase, continuing obligations after purchase. So now just a little bit about brownfields grantees and applicants generally. Remember again, brownfields grantees by statute in 104K, by statute, brownfields grantees are prohibited from using grant money to pay for a response cost for which the recipient of the grant is potentially liable under CERPLA. Therefore, in order to demonstrate that an applicant qualifies or is eligible for a brownfields grant, they need to show that they are otherwise not responsible for the contamination at the property. So therefore, then they can use the grant in order to address the contamination because they are not the responsible party. Now, there are several ways, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but there are several ways that particularly local governments and state governments can show that they're not liable. There are certain instances under CERCLA 101-35A, which basically provides that if the site is acquired by eminent domain, then there is a separate condition for which the government would not be found liable. Also, in CERCLA 101-20D, which is the definition of an owner-operator under CERCLA, there are provisions for which government entities are exempt from the definition of owner-operator. An exemption from the definition of owner-operator means you wouldn't be held liable because you are not the person, not the owner, you're not the operator at the time that the contamination happened. So in those cases, under 101-20D, those conditions are seizure, law enforcement activity, bankruptcy, tax delinquency, abandonment, and any other property acquisition that can be shown that the local or state government did by virtue of their function as sovereigns. In those cases that fall under CERCLA 101-20D, there's an exemption from liability, and in those cases, all appropriate inquiry does not apply. It doesn't apply to the liability provisions of CERCLA, but I would always say that doing a phase one environmental site assessment, either in compliance with the ASTM standard or the AAI standard, is always prudent prior to purchase a piece of property so that you know what you're getting into. Also, just for the eligibility for grantees, Congress did in the tooth did amend the CERCLA provisions just for grant eligibility that if a government entity purchased property prior to January 11th of 2002 and did not cause or contribute to contamination, even if they cannot show that they're a bona fide prospective purchaser, they're eligible for a brownfields grant. One thing I should have probably said in the previous slide that in addition, a threshold criteria for bona fide prospective purchaser is that you purchased the property prior to January 11th of 2002. But in the case of brownfields grantees, Congress said that if you purchased prior to 2002 and the local government can show they did not cause or contribute to contamination, they're eligible for grants. Doesn't mean that they're for other reasons that they have liability protection, but they are eligible for a grant. Next slide, please. Okay, now just a reminder about assessment grants. Any entity that gets a brownfields assessment grant and uses that grant, there's grant monies to do a phase one environmental site assessment. That phase one environmental site assessment has to be conducted in compliance with the all appropriate inquiries provisions. Next slide. In case of cleanup grants, the threshold criteria says that one, any applicant for a brownfields cleanup grant has to own the property for which they are going to be cleaning up. So basically, at the time of application, the applicant must own the property for which they're going to use the grant for the cleanup. Have to own the property. Also, all applicants, including federally recognized tribes, in order to be eligible for a cleanup grant, in addition to owning the property, you must have completed both a phase one and a phase two. A phase one that's done in compliance with the all appropriate inquiries requirements, and a phase two assessment on the property to be eligible for a cleanup grant. Why? Because when we give you funding to do cleanup, we want you to be ready to do the cleanup. So, in order to be ready to do the cleanup, you have to have done all of your due diligence and your environmental site assessments. One note about program development enhancement grants to states and tribes. This is under our CERCLA 128 program. EPA, in addition to providing competitive grants to government entities and nonprofits, we also have the authority. We usually have an appropriation each year for which we can give monies to states and tribes to help them run, pay for, and run their environmental response programs. The conditions of 128A do not include the same conditions that are adhered to for 104K. So basically, if a state or tribe does an environmental site assessment with their 128 funding, they don't have to comply to the same conditions as 104K program. All of that means that basically, if a state or tribe does a site assessment for a community and nonprofit for themselves, they don't have to, by statute, follow the all appropriate inquiry requirements. But it would be very silly, I think, and not prudent for any state or tribe to do a phase one site assessment for another entity and not comply with AAI, because if they don't comply with AAI, then that entity is not going to be eligible for a brownfields grant in the future. So all environmental site assessments that could be done in order for an entity to later apply for a brownfields cleanup grant, they all should be in compliance with the all appropriate inquiries requirement. Then one thing that about the most of you probably know or heard of the ASTM Phase One Environmental Site Assessment Standard. EPA has found we have reviewed the ASTM E1527. We've actually worked with ASTM in the development of their phase one environmental site assessment standards. And those standards we have found to be compliant with the all appropriate inquiries regulation. So the ASTM E1527-21, the current industry standard, and the ASTM E2247 16, which is the current forest land standard, EPA has found that they are compliant with the regulatory requirements of AAI and they can be used in lieu of following the regulatory requirements. So you can use these two standards. And if in doing your due diligence, you are compliant with those two standards, then you can consider that you've done your all appropriate inquiry. One note, there is another ASTM standard. It gets a little confusing because it has a very similar title. It's the E1528 standard. It's a transaction screen standard. It is not compliant. EPA does not recognize the transaction screen standard as equivalent or compliant with the AAI standard. So E1527, E2247, they're compliant, you can use them, and you'll be in compliance with the regulatory standard. 1528, not compliant, don't use it. Okay, now we have two quiz questions.
That's right. So I'm going to launch our first quiz question. And just like with the others, a new window should pop up on the screen asking the question, true or false, phase one ESAs conducted using Brownfield's assessment grant funds must be completed in compliance with the final AAI rule or appropriate ASTM phase one standards. So simply click the circle to the left of the answer, either true or false. If you do not know the how to get to that poll or you don't see it, you can always type in true or false into the Q&A response space, and then we will count your answer that way. And I will just thank the audience. I do see questions coming in, so keep those questions coming into the Q&A. We will pause in just a few moments to take a Q&A break here with our speakers, so you can continue to submit those questions into the Q&A break. And looking right now, I see about three quarters of you have responded to this quiz. So let me go ahead and close this one down in 3, 2, 1. And Patricia, it does look as though the audience almost overwhelmingly picked true. What is the right answer?
That is the right answer. Phase one is as conducting using EPA Brownfield Assessment Grant funds must be completed in compliance with the AAI rule or the appropriate ASTM standard. Absolutely true. As we said, you have to follow the AAI rule, or you can also use the ASTM E1527 or E1522-47.
Right. And so now we'll have a new one that's going to pop up on the screen. And this second question asks, is it true or false? Applicants must have completed a phase one ESA or AAI and a phase two assessment on the property to be eligible for a cleanup grant. Is this true or false? Again, simply click that circle to the left of your answer and then hit the submit button. And as I'm waiting for those responses to come in, I do see more questions coming into the Q&A window. So that is great. Keep those questions and comments coming in. We will break soon here in just a minute. I'll encourage those of you to take your best guess here because I'm going to close this poll down in 3, 2, 1. All right. Again, about three quarters of you voted. And now this one wasn't quite as clear. It looks like about a quarter of the audience picked false, but three quarters of them picked true. What's the right answer?
The correct answer is true. In order to be eligible for a Brownfields cleanup grant, the conditions were one, the applicant had to own the property at the time of application and also must have completed a phase one and a phase two prior to applying for the cleanup grant. Why? Because remember what I said on that. We want folks to be ready to conduct the cleanup. If you're applying for a cleanup grant, we want you to own the property, but we also require that you know what you're going to do with that cleanup money as soon as you get the grant. So you have to have conducted a phase one and a phase two prior to applying for a cleanup grant.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Okay, module two, we're going to go just quickly over the AAI regulation itself, what the AAI regulatory requirements are. And then after I'm done just giving you a broad brush of what the requirements are, Kevin's going to go into some more detail on how to actually put these requirements into practice. So one important thing, well, first of all appropriate inquiries regulations are codified in 40 CFR Part 312. So in the Code of Federal Regulations, you will find the all appropriate inquiries regulations at 40 CFR Part 312. So one important thing to consider when we go back to those threshold criteria for getting your liability protections, that's your contiguous property owner, your innocent landowner protection, and/or your bona fide prospective purchaser. Protection. The threshold criteria were one that you are not the liable party, you're not affiliated with the liable party, and you have to have conducted the all appropriate inquiry prior to acquiring the property. So prior to the date on which the title is transferred to the new property owner, prior to that date, the all appropriate inquiries must have been conducted and it must be documented in your reporting requirements that all appropriate inquiry was conducted prior to the date on which the property was transferred to the new owner. Also, within the all appropriate inquiry regulations, there are four requirements that have to have been conducted within 180 days prior to the date of acquisition. Those are your interviews, the records review, the on-site site inspection, and the search for environmental cleanup liens. Kevin will go a little bit in a little more detail on what these activities actually entail. But those activities, interviews, records review, the on-site site inspection, and the environmental cleanup lien search have been conducted within 180 days prior to the date of acquisition. Why? Because again, we want the new owner, the person that is acquiring the property, to understand the environmental conditions at the property when they're acquiring the property, not the conditions that were known 5 years ago or 2 years ago or even 1 year ago, but what are the conditions of the property, the environmental concerns that are present at the property at the time of acquisition. So, another provision of the all appropriate inquiries rule is we outline, EPA outlines in the rule that's at 30, at 40 rather, CFR Part 312, is who can perform the all appropriate inquiries. Basically, there needs to be a person supervising or overseeing the conduct of the AI that meets the definition of environmental professional in the AAI regulation. So in the regulation at 40 CFR Part 312-312.10, basically there is a regulatory definition of environmental professional. The person who oversees and the person who's going to sign the report saying that it was done in compliance with AAI, that person must meet the definition in the regulation. Without going into all the detail, basically, the regulation again at 312.10 basically says in order to be an environmental professional, you have to have specific education and training. You have to meet specific education and training requirements. And there are certain conditions that are outlined in the regulation that basically the person overseeing has to have a degree and a certain number of years of experience, or in this case, without a degree in science or engineering, has to have a number of years of experience, and also has to have a certain amount of relevant experience. Next slide. Okay, so the regulation after tells you when you have to do it, who has to oversee it or be in charge of the all appropriate inquiry. Then it also lays out some objectives and performance standards for the all appropriate inquiry investigation. So basically, objectives and performance standards. So what do you need to do? What are you looking for? What are you trying to do when you're doing an all appropriate inquiry investigation? First, mainly you're trying to identify the conditions that are indicative of releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances. If you're trying to find evidence that there were or were not releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances at the property. Why? Because that's where liability attaches under the Superfund law. Under CERCLA, liability attaches to releases and threatened releases of hazardous substances. Therefore, when an all appropriate inquiry is conducted, a phase one environmental assessment is conducted, the person conducting that investigation is trying to determine whether there is evidence of the pro at the property that there was or were releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances. And basically, how do you do that? Kevin will go in more detail in a bit, but basically, who used the property, who occupied the property, what kinds of hazardous substances were managed or used at the property, how were they managed, what were the waste management activities that were conducted. Were there corrective actions or response activities that were conducted at the property? If there were, that's pretty good indication that there were hazardous substances at the property at one time. You want to know how they were cleaned up and to what degree they were cleaned up. Also, are there institutional controls or engineering controls at the property? Why do you want to know that? Because remember those continuing obligations that I mentioned earlier? You can't violate the integrity of institutional controls or engineering controls. They have to be in compliance with those. Also, what happened at nearby and adjoining properties? Are there environmental conditions at the property next door or the property a half a mile away that could be impacting the property that you're about to purchase? So then, in addition to the objectives, performance factors, then we also have basically some common sense provisions in the all appropriate inquiries rule. And that, as far as gathering the information, doing your due diligence, we of course say that the information that you're looking for has to be publicly available. You have to be able to obtain it within a reasonable time frame and within some cost constraints. And you have to be able to practically review that information once you've obtained it. So what we're requiring you to do is gather the information that's publicly available or that you can obtain rather easily, some that might be when you do your on-site site inspection. Then you have to review it and evaluate the thoroughness and the reliability of the information that's gathered. A little bit about contaminants of concern. Parties that are seeking a circle defense. So basically, perhaps not a grantee at this point, but you're not applying for, or your client is not applying for a Brownfields grant, but basically you're thinking your client or you are thinking of acquiring a property and you just want to make sure that you're going to not be held liable for previous releases, that basically then you're doing your all appropriate inquiry to seek that CERCLA defense, and you're looking for releases and threatened releases of CERCLA hazardous substances. So anything that's a CERCLA hazardous substance is a release that you could be potentially held liable for. Therefore, that's what you're looking for. Now, Brownfields grant recipients can use their Brownfields grants to address constituents that go beyond the CERCLA hazardous substances. So basically, if you are doing an all appropriate inquiry and investigation for an EPA grantee, I know we have several environmental consultants, engineering firm representatives for engineering firms on the training today. So basically, if you're doing an all appropriate inquiries investigation, a phase one investigation for an EPA grantee, you may need, for the purposes of the grantee, to search for releases and threatened releases, not just of CERCLA hazardous substances, but also pollutants and contaminants, perhaps petroleum products, perhaps controlled substances, and or mine scarred land waste. Any of those substances, releases of any of those contaminants, can be addressed with EPA Brownfields funding. Next slide, please. So with that, I am handing it over to Kevin Pelaya, who's going to go through a bit more detail about how one conducts a phase one environmental site assessment.
Patricia, if it's okay, I think we have a couple of questions that we'll pause here and take, and then we'll move on. I want to get through some of these preliminary concepts that are coming in before we move on. Is that okay with you?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So we had some questions that came early on in terms of some of the phrases. So could you explain what you mean by contiguous property owner liability protection? Or the codified EPA groundwater policy?
Yes. Prior to the 2002 amendments to CERCLA, the Brownfields, what we call the Brownfields amendments, EPA had what we call the contaminated groundwater policy, which basically said that if a property owner's groundwater was contaminated from a source not on that property, not on that owner's property, so basically you didn't have a release of hazardous substances on your property, but somewhere around you, one of your neighbors contaminated, had a release of a hazardous substance that leaked to the groundwater. You are downstream, and now your groundwater is contaminated. It was EPA's enforcement discretion policy that we wouldn't hold you liable for the contamination of your groundwater by a nearby property owner. So the contiguous property owner provision basically codifies that EPA provision. It basically says if your groundwater is contaminated, it wasn't your fault. The source is not on your property. You will not be held liable for that contamination. Liability stays with the owner of the property that had the source of the contamination.
Okay. And another quick term, what is eminent domain?
What is eminent domain? Oh, that's I won't be able to spew out the legal definition of eminent domain, but basically there is a takings provision that let's say maybe I can tell you through an example. Let's say the state of, I don't know, Pennsylvania or XYZ Pennsylvania or XYZ state decides that they need to build a highway to get from point A to point B. Their needs for transportation purposes, they decide that there's a real need for a highway, but that the best place to put that highway is right across some commercial and/or residential properties. The state can take those properties for public good. So basically, state governments, particularly, can take properties for public good. So they could take those properties, and but in most state law, I think eminent domain is basically ruled by state law that in most cases the landowner has to be compensated, and the state will determine what the compensation must be. But eminent domain says the state has the right to take properties, to take that property and use that property for the public good.
Okay. Could you tell us, is a title search the same as an environmental cleanup lien search?
No, those are two different things. The title search is something that you do for almost every piece of property to make sure there are that the chain of title is proper, that and that you and that the person who basically the person that's selling you the property has the right to sell you the property because they're in the chain of title. So a chain of title is a different legal search and document than a search for environmental cleanup liens. Now, I say that, although in some localities, some local laws, a chain of custody search will also include information on liens.
Okay.
But an environmental cleanup lien is when if someone else pays for the cleanup of the property, and the property owner does not fully compensate the person who did the cleanup, then a lien can be put on that property for the payment of the cleanup cost. And often, well, often it's not often if a state or EPA does a cleanup, particularly if it's an imminent and substantial endangerment issue where EPA has to go in, has to do the cleanup in order to make sure the human health and the environment is not damaged significantly, then EPA will pay for the cleanup, but then we will charge the cleanup costs back to the property owner. And in those cases, we would put a lien on the property. The all appropriate inquiries investigation requires the all appropriate inquiry to do a search for cleanup liens for the sole purpose of you understanding that there may have been a cleanup. So the idea there is not so much what the cost was or who paid or whether it was settled, but basically the idea in an all appropriate inquiry is it provides you information saying there was a cleanup done at the property.
Okay. Can an AST, or should point blank, ASTM 21 and 16 both must be used, or can only one of those be used at a property?
The ASTM 15, 27, 21 should be used. EPA recognized it a year ago, and until February of 2004, we're also recognizing the 15, 27, 16. But as of February of 2024, we're only recognizing the updated standard, which is the 15, 27, 21.
Okay. All right, a few more questions here. And I know we hit on some of these with the quizzes, but I want to make sure we get a clear answer just in case there are any lingering doubts in the audience. Can grantees meet the AAI requirements without doing a full-scale phase one?
No, I'm not really sure what the trick is with that question, but basically, you have to do either the full ASTM 1527 or you have to comply with all of the provisions of the all-appropriate increase rule.
Okay, and on a similar approach, if a phase two is recommended, must it be conducted to comply with the AAI?
No, if a phase two is recommended, that's outside of the AAI provision. You could satisfy the conditions of AAI and the conditions of being a bona fide prospective purchaser as far as the AAI provision. But remember the continuing obligations. So basically, if your phase one comes back and says, we recommend or highly recommend, or you should do a phase two, keep in mind that if you don't, you may have trouble complying with the continuing obligations portion of the liability standards.
Okay. How long does it usually take to conduct a phase one and phase two? One of the participants, they essentially say that both of them have a set life, so they expire after a certain amount of time, and they wondered if you could ever do a phase one while conducting a phase two. Like, if have you ever had a scenario where you have to go back and redo the phase one because it expired while you were working on your phase two?
The only thing that would cause the phase one to expire is if you didn't purchase the property within a year of completing the phase one. It has nothing to do with when you do the phase two. Compliance with the 1 year requirement has to do with when you purchase the property, not when you start your phase two.
Okay. And then a few questions here on the 180-day time frame. One of the attendees asked, do interviews within that 180-day requirement include getting a new user questionnaire?
You mean under the 1527, there is a user questionnaire that most environmental professionals will use in order to conduct the interview. They don't need to use the questionnaire, but the ASTM E1527 recommends it. So the interviews have to be completed within 180 days, and if the environmental professional determines that the interview wasn't completed and needs a new questionnaire, then I would say the new questionnaire also would have to be conducted within the 180 days because the EP, the environmental professional, must sign off to say it's complete. And so the interviews, as determined by the environmental professional, must be complete. And if the environmental professional decides they're not complete until a second interview questionnaire is completed, then all of that has to be done within the 180 days prior to acquisition of property.
Okay. How about this one? If an AAI has been conducted within 180 days, but the purchase comes after the 180-day time frame, and there's been no change in the property, so for example, a Superfund site that has remained fallow for years, can that original AAI still be used?
All of the information can be used, but the environmental professional needs to go through and be sure and be able to certify that there are no changes. So all the information can be used from a prior investigation, from a prior partial investigation, but all of that information has to be certified by the environmental professional that it's still true and compliant.
Okay, just two more questions and we'll carry on. Last one on the 180 days. Does a 180 day on a phase one include the environmental lien search?
Yes.
Okay. And then back to those environmental professionals. Would a scientist with 10 years of experience be considered a professional able to do this work? And they're asking because they don't have official licensing like an engineer or geologist.
If you have a degree and 10 years of relevant experience, yes.
All right. That is the end of the questions that I see in the queue. So I think at this time we can go ahead and move on to the next segment here. So Kevin, I will spotlight your video. I want to thank the participants for sharing those questions and encourage you to keep them coming. And we'll take another break here in just a little bit. Kevin, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks, Jean, and thanks, Patricia. Good afternoon, everybody. So in the next couple modules, we're going to discuss some of the key activities that make up a phase one environmental set assessment or an AAI assessment, and really discuss what is best practice in the industry. And while this training will not necessarily make you an expert in performing a phase one, it will give you a better sense of what is required so that you can better judge the quality of reports that you may be reviewing, such as those being prepared with Brownfields grant funding, or if you're a prospective property purchaser and you've hired a consultant to prepare a phase one for you, you'll have a better sense of what to be looking for, and if in fact the reports that you are looking at are compliant with AAI. So again, this slide just more or less reiterates what Patricia mentioned. You know, the phase one really is that initial assessment of a site to identify you know, the potential presence of environmental contamination, or the term that's used in the ASTM standard is recognized environmental conditions or RECs. And the site assessment and remediation process can include many different stages, as Patricia noted, a phase one, a phase two, cleanup, redevelopment. And so AAI really just focuses on that initial step to get a sense of, does this property contain any environmental conditions that might be indicative of releases of hazardous substances? Phase ones are conducted for real estate transaction. They're conducted for site discovery. They're conducted for CERCLA liability protection. Under Brownfields grants, they're conducted, and also just to generally assess what the business environmental risk concerns are during a transaction of a property. I should point out what a phase one ESA is not. And a phase one is not going to delineate the contamination or quantify the human health or ecological risk that may be associated with contaminants at the property. Typically taking samples of soil, groundwater, analyzing them for contaminants and chemical constituents, and comparing those concentrations to risk criteria is part of a phase two environmental site assessment, which we're not going to talk about to any great degree today, but we will touch upon it. In fact, we'll talk a little bit about some of the non-scope considerations later in the webinar that do sort of get closer into the phase two type activities. On a cost perspective, you know, phase one environmental assessments can be as little as, you know, $2,000, $2,500 for a relatively small, benign site, but they can escalate to much higher costs for larger, more complicated industrial sites. We're going to go into the detail of what you know, what AAI is and what's required by AAI, but the overall purposes are shown here. You know, they are to identify previous owners and occupants, identify how the land was used or the property was used in the past, what types and quantities of hazardous substances and chemicals were used, what types of waste management practices were in place. Look at what the current and you know previous property conditions are, and understand the uses and conditions of surrounding properties. It's important to know that if there's contamination on abutting properties that migrates onto the subject property, that's something that should be identified as part of a part of an inquiry. So this slide summarizes what the key activities or requirements of a phase one environmental site assessment or AAI assessment are, and those being interviews, it's number one, review of documents, including historical sources, government records, and activity and use limitations, and visual inspections. And we're going to go into detail on each of these different steps in the subsequent slides. But I should note that while I've presented these in a particular order in these slides, it's important to point out that the assessment should really involve an integrated approach of assessing each of these different lines of evidence. It's not a, step one, step two, step three. Each of the activities here should be used to validate and confirm information that is gathered from these other activities. And I'll get into that in a minute here. Lastly, AAI also retained four of the requirements from the previous innocent landowner defense provisions under the SARA amendments that Patricia mentioned. And those are listed here. The inquiry or the phase one assessment must evaluate the following four items. And these really get at issues that the user or the person relying on the phase one environmental site assessment should be aware of. They include the relationship of the purchase price versus the market value of the property. For example, if the asking price of a property is significantly below market value, there may be a reason for that. They may be looking to get rid of it at a deeply discounted price because it may have some environmental issues and costs associated with that. Secondly, if the user, again, the person relying on that phase one assessment, has any specialized knowledge of the property, that the environmental professional should also be aware of that. Thirdly, any commonly known or reasonably ascertainable information. And Patricia mentioned this earlier, but for example, if the user and everyone else in the town knows that the property was formerly a dry cleaner, this is information that the environmental professional should be made aware of. So that's commonly known, reasonably ascertainable information. And lastly, the degree of obviousness and ability to detect. The degree of obviousness of the presence or likely presence of contamination at the property, and the ability to detect contamination. For example, are there any obvious indicators that point to the presence or likely presence of releases at the subject property? So first, we're going to talk about the interview requirements. And under the all appropriate inquiry regulation, the requirement is that an interview with the current owner and occupant of the subject property be performed. So the current owner and occupant, and that could mean a number of things, particularly depending on the size of the property. If it's a single operation, there may be one current owner or occupant. If it's a large property that's got multiple operations, there may be, several owners and occupants, but it's really those major occupants with those that focus on the use and storage of hazardous materials. And it's not sufficient to just ask one person. If they don't know, if that owner or occupant doesn't know, it's up to the environmental professional to seek out parties that do know what sort of environmental conditions are at the property. And I'll go into that in a little bit more around who are the best individuals to interview. In order to achieve the objective and performance factors of all appropriate inquiry, additional interviews are also required, and on top of just the current owners and occupants. And that could be current facility managers or prior employees. It could also involve interviews of past owners, operators, and occupants. So, for example, if the current owner has only been at the property for, say, 5 years, but you have information to suggest that that property has been operating for 50 years in some industrial capacity, it may be prudent to interview past owners and past occupants of that property to really understand what the full history of the environmental conditions are. That current owner that's only been there for 5 years, that may not do it. So, with respect to abandoned properties, and by abandoned, I mean that there is no known or available current owner or occupant, the regulation requires interviewing at least one owner or occupant of neighboring or nearby properties. So if there's no current owner or no current occupant, the property is abandoned, the environmental professional must attempt to interview somebody on a neighboring or nearby property. Now, obviously, there are different criteria and things to think about when selecting which neighbor is best. For instance, location relative to the site. Is that neighboring property or abutting property upgradient or downgradient? Is it upwind or downwind? They may have a different perspective. Years of existence. How long has that abutting property been in existence? Have they been there for as long as the subject property has? If they have, they might have a better sense of what the history at that subject property was all about. What's their vantage point? Just because you're in a butter doesn't necessarily mean you can see what's going on at the subject property. So can that abutting property or nearby property, do they have a vantage point that allows them to see and observe activities at that property? And lastly, judgment. I mean, the environmental professional obviously has to use judgment as to, which neighbors are friendly. Not everybody's willing to talk about activities occurring at somebody else's property. So there's a lot of judgment involved in terms of who's willing to talk and who's not willing to talk. So while the AAI regulation and ASTM standard don't specify any particular method for how and when to perform interviews, this slide highlights some of the possible approaches. And as far as how to conduct the interview, from my professional experience, having done, several hundred of these, conducting the interview in person, I find is always the most effective. It having that face-to-face interview allows the environmental professional to validate and confirm other information that they're collecting, or they may have collected from the document review, as well as from the visual site inspection. As you're doing a visual site inspection, which we'll talk about in a moment here, you can ask questions. You can ask follow-up questions of the individuals that you're interviewing. It really does allow for a great opportunity to ask those follow-up questions about potential recognized environmental conditions and other environmental conditions. Now, as far as the how, most credible environmental consulting firms or contractors have some sort of checklist or a questionnaire or a protocol that they use to guide the interview. I know, for instance, ours is, a 20 plus page questionnaire protocol that covers a lot of different areas. And so it's prudent to have something like that present so that you're ensuring that you're sort of capturing all of the different questions and issues that you need to be looking for. Telephone interviews are also effective, but I find that these are usually best used either as a, in advance of the site visit or as a follow-up to the in-person interview or after the site visit. Phone interviews are also effective if you need to reach out to past owners and occupants who obviously aren't physically present at the subject property, and they may no longer live nearby. As far as when to conduct the interviews, again, during the site visit is probably the most effective, but may not always be possible due to the availability of the different interviewees. And as far as who to interview, well, we know that the regulation requires that the current owner and occupant be interviewed, but who within that organization are the best individuals to talk to? Oftentimes the actual owner of the property doesn't really know a whole lot about the ins and outs of the daily operations, waste handling, waste storage, and that sort of thing. So it may be better to interview the property manager or somebody who might be responsible for the environmental safety and health aspects of the business, perhaps a business, a building engineer. Other individuals as part of the organization that could be helpful to interview would be human resource employees. And you ask why HR? But oftentimes it's HR who understands whether there may be any employee-related complaints due to environmental exposures. Also, attorneys might be aware of complaints and lawsuits associated with environmental releases, either by current employees or abutters. And financial managers may be aware of recent or planned capital expenditures that are associated with environmental issues. So each of those individuals could offer a different perspective on different environmental aspects of an analysis. As far as, common interview questions, as I said, most credible firms have, questionnaires, protocols that are several pages long. So I don't have time to go through all of those questions. But the questions really should confirm the visual observations and the information that is collected in the document review. But also gather more detailed information about the observations. That can't be determined during the visual observation. So this slide just lists a few of the common questions. And as I said, most firms have lengthy questionnaires that will touch upon these. Just a couple of them have investigations or remedial actions occurred. If there's evidence that there have been investigations or remediation, pretty good sense that there was a release of some point. What sort of permits does the facility have? Do they have permits to discharge wastewater or stormwater? Have any known spills or releases occurred? These types of questions. I could go on and on, but this just gives you just a handful of the common questions that should be asked during the interview process. AAI and ASTM, the ASTM standard also suggests that the environmental professional gather information through interviews of various state, local, and tribal government officials. And by that, what I mean is a reasonable attempt should be made to interview at least one of these sources. It really is good practice to include interviews with state, local, tribal government agencies, as it helps to, again, to validate or confirm the information that the owner or occupant interviews revealed. Sometimes interviewees, either purposefully or not, are not always the most accurate or truthful. So having an additional way to validate that feedback is crucial to the quality of the assessment. And by interviewing some of these government organization agencies, that's one way to validate the information. Fire departments typically keep records of tanks on the property, and they're oftentimes the first responder to any spills or releases that may occur. So they may have some information about that type of information. Departments of health or boards of health at the local level are often aware of any public health related issues that might be associated with the site. So interviewing the local boards of health might be a prudent step. Building departments, water departments, engineering departments, and these types at the local level usually have records of permits on file related to water wells, stormwater, wastewater discharge, this type of thing. So these are all really valuable resources for additional interviews. So the next key activity that I want to talk about is the records review. And this is where the environmental professional gathers written documentation about both the historical uses of the site, as well as information about the site that is contained in federal, state, tribal, or local government records to determine its environmental regulatory status. So there are a number of commercial vendors now that provide these search services at a reasonable fee, a few hundred dollars type thing. And typically you can request this search, and within days, sometimes within just a matter of hours, the environmental professional can get an electronic delivery of several different sources of both historical documents, and I'll talk a little bit about the types of historical documents in a minute, as well as pulls from the state, federal, and tribal government databases. But just a word of caution with these commercial search firms: while they have improved significantly over the years, now that pretty much everything is online, these commercial search firms have a valuable wealth of information. They don't always include very robust information from local and tribal government agencies. So it may be necessary for the environmental professional to make calls, submit document requests, or actually physically visit local and tribal offices, because those records are not always part of these commercial search search requests from these commercial vendors. One of the things with respect to reviewing historical sources of information, the AI regulation requires that historical sources be reviewed that can cover, a certain time period. And this is to ensure that all of the prior uses of the property are fully assessed. Now, this is one sort of minor difference between the AAI regulation and the ASTM standard in terms of, how far back in time does one need to go? AAI requires that the search cover a period of time as far back as when the property first contained structures and was used for residential, agricultural, commercial, and government purposes. While the ASTM requires that the review covered a period of time back to when it was first developed or 1940, whichever is earlier. So a slight difference there, but the point is that you want to review records back to a point in time when that property was first developed for its initial use. And if a property has changed hands frequently, or if it's got a long industrial history, hundreds of years, this review can be a pretty exhaustive use, particularly in more developed areas where oftentimes we see a lot of brownfield sites. So what are some of the common historical sources that environmental professionals should be reviewing? Well, the AI regulation does. It doesn't require any specific historical sources of information be reviewed. It only requires that at least one source be reviewed. Now, that said, the ASTM standard, ASTM 1527, which Patricia mentioned, does specify certain sources that should be reviewed, and a number of those are included here on this slide. Sources may include, but are not limited to what is shown here. And each of these types of records provides some type of information about the current and prior usage of the property, as well as for the abutting properties. As I mentioned, these same commercial vendors that are providing the government records database search also have a number of these documents readily available, again, at a relatively low cost, including things like aerial photographs, fire insurance maps, topographic maps, street directories, and a number of other items here. A lot of us forget, with everything being online now, that local libraries and newspaper archives are also still extremely valuable. Not all of that information has been, digitized, but oftentimes I've found myself in local libraries digging into data to try to assess the history of some older properties that may, not show up something on a quick Google search. As I said, aerial photographs are one of the most valuable sources of historic information. They can really tell a lot about what has happened at a property over time. And there are now online free resources via Google Earth, for instance, where you can get aerial imagery from different decades over time. So you just go into Google Earth, type in the your address, and you can look at aerial imagery from current day. You can look at a shot from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. It really tells a story of how that land use has changed. This slide here is just an example of an aerial photograph from a lead acid battery plant that I did a phase one at a number of years ago. And it was interesting, as I was doing the site inspection at the site, I actually noticed this photo hanging on the wall. And what grabbed my attention here, well, there were a number of things that grabbed my attention, but what was particularly interesting was the yellow staining on the roof, as you can see at the sort of the center of the building. After further questioning during the on-site interviews, it turns out that the facility previously had a paint booth that had been converted to a storage room. So you'd never know walking through that storage room that they had used to do painting, but looking at this aerial imagery, it was pretty clear that some sort of emissions were coming out of the center portion of that building. So in fact, that the yellow staining did suggest that there was improper emission controls back in time, and that there could potentially have been soil contamination. So that did lead to a recognized environmental condition or REC. At the same site, a similar aerial photo revealed this very faint oval-shaped outline on the ground surface on a separate portion of the property. And after further questioning, further site walked, it turned out that was the old and unlined industrial wastewater lagoon that had since been covered over, and grass had grown, but you could still see that faint outline. So aerial photos are very important, very powerful sources of information to understand the history of the operations. The next type that I find a very helpful historic resources are fire insurance maps. Some of you have heard these referred to as Sanborn maps, and these are large scale maps that were produced to assist fire insurance companies to assess potential risks when insuring a property. And what's fascinating about the fire insurance maps is they date back into the 1800s. And they identify some of the previous ownership of properties. So where you have a site that's got, 50, 100 years of activity, these are really helpful to understand, what some of the prior uses of that property were. And again, these fire insurance maps typically can be ordered through that same commercial, search firm that I discussed earlier. So, in addition to the historical resources, AAI and ASTM require a search of government records, both for the subject property as well as nearby and adjoining properties, which I've mentioned. The search must be performed of files or databases containing these records for federal, state, and local governments. If your property is located on or near tribal lands, a tribal record search must also be performed for that property. So, as I said before, use caution because these commercial search firms don't always have tribal records included. It's really up to the tribe, given the sovereign nature of tribal organizations. Some are willing to provide some of that data and information to these commercial search firms, others are not. And in that case, the environmental professional should look, locally at tribal offices to try to gather some additional records. Let's see, let's move on to the next slide here. So this kind of gives you a little bit hard to read. If you open up the ASTM standard, you can see this a little bit more clearly, but this illustrates the required list of federal, state, local, and tribal records that must be searched and their search distances. And as you can see on the slide in the right-hand column, typically the search involves searching out, at least, a half a mile up to a mile distance from the subject property for a number of these databases. So this includes things like Superfund sites on the National Priority List or NPL. It includes RCRA sites, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. It looks at RCRA generators, waste generators. It looks at state and tribal Superfund sites or the equivalent Superfund sites, hazardous waste sites, landfills, solid waste disposal facilities, tanks, leaking underground storage tanks, institutional controls, brownfield sites. The list kind of goes on and on. You can take a look, but again, a lot of this can be pretty easily acquired through these commercial firms. And while the list does seem daunting, like I said, a lot of this is online now, so the information can be gathered pretty quickly. Understanding what databases a site might be listed on can be very informative, and it gives the environmental professional an immediate sense of potential environmental issues before even stepping on the site. I mean, typically, what I've done in the past is you order this database search before you're out there on your site visit. This immediately gives you a sense of whether the site is, listed on any of these properties, what some of the abutting or nearby properties are listed as. So having this in hand prior to the site visit is always very, very helpful. And this just gives you an example of one of the outputs that you typically get from one of these searches. Oftentimes it's a map that, indicates where your target property is, in this case, the green star. And then it also lists other sites at different, radii from the property. with indications of where some other sites nearby, abutting sites might be. Once you dive into the report itself, it gives you some more information about why each of these properties are listed on the search. So again, this is nice to have before the site visit. And oftentimes these are typically if you're reviewing a phase one, if you're a user and you've ordered a phase one, this is something you typically see as an appendix in a phase one report. So in addition to the government records that are required to be searched, there are also several other types of non-governmental records and non-historic sources of information that the environmental professional may review as part of their assessment. And now, not all of these are required by AAI or the ASTM standard, but it's good practice for the environmental professional to be looking for these types of documents. Again, we don't have time to go through all of these, but a facility or property plot plan or map is something that's always very helpful. It gives you a sense of where, different waste management activities may have occurred, where there may be tanks, where there may be, wastewater lines, that sort of thing. Any previous investigation reports or monitoring reports, again, that's a clear indication that there may have been a release that, maybe something's been done about it, or maybe it hasn't been. So again, it's a long list of different types of records, inventories of tanks, chemical inventories, spill and release reports, this sort of thing. So even before stepping on a property and collecting and analyzing samples, there are some commonly known contaminants and related contaminant sources that a phase one can begin to identify through the records view in interviewing process. Again, we're not collecting samples as part of a phase one, but if there are reports or other documents that suggest some work has been done, just by knowing what a site did, the environmental professional should immediately understand the types of contaminants they're going to be looking for. For example, any operations that involve dry cleaning or parts washing, the environmental professional should be looking for chlorinated solvents such as perchloroethylene, trichloroethylene, PCE, TCE, and their breakdown products. Similarly, sites that have old electric transformers are likely to have had polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs. And obviously, gas station properties, will have fuel-related contaminants such as benzene, toluene, ethylene, xylene, MTBE, et cetera. Not only will knowledge of these different industries and processes assist in developing the RECs as part of your phase one, but they'll also help the environmental professional to identify recommendations for additional investigations as part of the conclusion of the phase one report, which I'll talk about in the next module here. The next two slides really are just more for reference, as if you are reviewing a phase one report or even a phase two report, these slides try to make a little bit of sense of the analytical data that you typically are going to see. Which may be one, analytical data as part of a phase two report, which may be a record that you're reviewing as part of a phase one. Soil and groundwater analytical data are presented in reports in several different ways, and this list provides some of the common units of measure associated with environmental data. So as you can see, there are quite a few, and it can get confusing in terms of converting and trying to convert between units. But fortunately, in environmental chemistry, we're generally concerned with relatively limited subset of units. For instance, the top two categories, the parts per million or part per billion categories, they cover the lion's share of what we typically see when reporting contaminant concentrations. However, as health risk criteria continue to become more stringent and analytical instrumentation becomes more advanced, looking for contaminants at the part per trillion and even the part per quadrillion basis, are becoming more common, especially for some of the more emerging contaminants such as the per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, which I'm sure you've heard, many of you heard of, or dioxins and furans. This is again more of just sort of a reference slide to help you think through these things. And also, this is a similar slide. This really just gives you a few examples to demonstrate how low of a level of detection is required to measure concentrations of environmental contaminants and in order to meet certain regulatory risk criteria and standards. For example, one part per million is equivalent of a few drops of water in an entire bathtub. One part per million is also equivalent to about one person in the entire state of Rhode Island or the entire state of Delaware. One part per billion is equivalent to a pinch of salt in 10 tons of potato chips, or one part per billion is also equal to 1 second in a 32-year time period. So this just gives you a sense of, that it doesn't take a very large volume of a spill or an environmental release to contaminate an aquifer beyond risk criteria. A simple 5 gallon bucket of chlorinated solvent can very easily contaminate an entire aquifer above drinking water maximum contaminant levels. Okay, so the last type of record required to be searched are the environmental cleanup liens that are filed or recorded. Patricia touched upon these already, so I won't go into a whole lot of detail, but a lien is a charge or claim against a property that secures payment of debt or performance of some other obligation and is typically imposed by a creditor. The liens are typically filed at the local level as part of land title records. And the important thing is here is not the how much was the cleanup lien, but if there is an environmental cleanup lien placed on that property, it is an indication that some type of environmental response action occurred in the past. So that alone should give the environmental professional a sense of, okay, something happened in the past, and I need to look into that in a little bit more detail. So that wraps up the records review requirement, and the next key activity is the visual inspection, which honestly is the most fun part of this whole process. Actually getting feet on the ground, boots on the ground, to take and make some visual observations of the property. Both the AAI regulation and the ASTM standard require that an on-site visual inspection be completed. And again, this means somebody needs to physically get on site and make visual observations of the activities and the operation. And that site inspection or site reconnaissance should really focus on those areas where hazardous substances may be or may have been used, stored, treated, handled, or disposed of in the past. So that really should be the focus of the site inspection, is those types of areas. Under the ASTM standard and AAI, adjoining properties should also be inspected, either from the subject property itself or from a public right of way. Again, you want to know if the abutting properties are adversely impacting the subject property. It's an important part of the phase one assessment. AAI and ASTM standard also require that any limitations of the visual inspection be noted and documented in the report. For example, if you can't access the property due to certain circumstances, be it safety, there may be a part of the building that is unsafe to enter. That you may have limited access to certain parts of the property. I'm based in the Northeast here. It snows several months out of the year. Oftentimes, snow covering the ground, may limit certain things that you can see. So really, the regulation and the ASTM standard require that if you can't do a visual inspection, that you document that and try to observe the property through other means, be it aerial photographs or other means. The next couple of slides In the interest of time, I'm going to move pretty quickly. I mean, these just kind of give you a list of the typical things that the environmental professional should be looking for, both in terms of the general site setting, as well as interior and exterior conditions, during the site visit. Again, most credible firms have questionnaires that sort of point you to a lot of these different things. Just a few examples. Soil staining, any stained soil or distressed vegetation, discolored water, that type of thing may indicate that there was a release of some sort. I always find that random pipes exiting the ground, why are those there? What were those used for in the past? Another classic one is roads that maybe lead to nowhere. Where do they lead? What was done in the past to, why is that road there? In a similar fashion here, hazardous substances, petroleum products, these are the types you want to be looking for. Are there any storage tanks, drums, or containers? The image on the right, this the lower right-hand corner is from a phase one assessment that I did years ago at a metal plating facility. And this was a photo from the wastewater treatment room at that facility. And obviously there's some obvious signs of leakage from the drum that's holding the corrosive materials, that black drum there. But what was actually of most concern was the location of that drum. It's immediately adjacent to a floor drain. So the environmental professional should be asking, okay, well, where does that floor drain go? Does it lead to a dry well? Does it enter a pipe into a nearby brook? Does it go to a treatment system? In this case, the facility had a proper wastewater treatment system. In fact, that floor drain led to that treatment system, so everything was fine. But those are the types of things that environmental professionals should be looking for as part of their investigation. This is another example from that same lead acid battery plant in South Carolina. I was looking at a map and an aerial photo, and I noticed a road that seemed, again, to lead to nowhere. It just dead ended in the woods, near the back of the property. So during the site visit, we drove around the property, drove down the road, and it literally led to the back 40, where a number of rusted drums, debris, and obvious illicit disposal over many years have occurred. So this obviously led to a recognized environmental condition in our report. Led to additional phase two sampling. This is the type of thing that you're not necessarily going to see on an aerial photo. You may not see it in the documents, but you will see it on the site visits. Okay, so that wraps up the key activities that are required by AAI and ASTM standard. Before we move on to the phase one reporting, we've just got one quick quiz question here for you. So, Jean?
All right, I'm going to launch this next one. There should be a pop-up window that appears now on the screen asking which of the following is not a required activity of a phase one ESA or AAI. Is it visual inspection of property, interviews with owners and occupants, asbestos and lead-based paint sampling, or a review of the historical sources of information? So simply click the circle to the left of what you think is the right answer, and then you can go ahead and hit that submit button. We'll give you just a few more seconds to review and cast your responses. And then we'll close this poll here in just a few more seconds. It looks like about three quarters of you have voted, so I'll go ahead and close that in 3, 2, 1. Now, Kevin, it looks like almost everybody said asbestos and lead-based paint sampling. Are they right?
They are. And this was a softball, honestly. This was an easy one, but correct. As I mentioned, sampling and analysis is not a requirement of a phase one environmental site assessment, but it is something that is commonly performed as a non-scope consideration, which I'll talk about briefly here, especially on older buildings built prior to the 1970s, 1980s, and certainly a lot of brownfields fall into that category. So we'll be talking a little bit more about that glad everyone's listening here and got that one right. So thanks, Jean. Okay, so moving on. So now you've finished up the interviews, you've done your document reviews, you've done your physical, visual on-site inspection. And so it's time to write the report. And AAI and the ASTM standard require that the assessment be documented in a physical written report. So next, we're going to spend a few minutes on those reporting requirements and what you should be looking for in a phase one ESA report. As I said, the results must be documented in a written report. And under the AAI regulation, the report must include the following four or five things. First, that the environmental professional provide an opinion as to whether the inquiry identified any recognized environmental conditions. So that's number one. Second is the identification of any data gaps. So if there were any significant data gaps, and we'll talk a little bit about what significant means in a moment here, if there were any significant data gaps identified that affected the environmental professional's ability to draw conclusions regarding the environmental conditions, then they must be identified and presented in the report. AAI also requires that there be declarations of the qualifications of the environmental professional and a declaration that the inquiry was performed in accordance with the AAI regulation. And lastly, the environmental professional who oversaw the inquiry must sign and date the report. Now, these are really just the bare minimum reporting requirements under the AAI regulation. And in reality and in practice, most environmental professionals follow the ASTM standard, which includes several other suggested components for the report, and we'll talk about that in a moment here. So first, the environmental professional opinion. The environmental professional must include an opinion as to whether the inquiry identified conditions that were indicative of releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances on, at, or near the subject property. These are also referred to as recognized environmental conditions. And usually this opinion is included in the conclusion section of the report. I'll go through a slide in a moment here about the different sections you might want to see in a report, but typically the opinion is part of the conclusion section. The environmental professional must also include an opinion as to whether additional appropriate investigations, such as phase two sampling and analysis, are warranted based on the conclusions of the phase one assessment. So it's an opinion regarding whether additional investigations might be warranted or might be prudent based on what they found. Again, sampling and analysis is not required under phase one, but the environmental professional's opinion about whether additional investigation is required. And this opinion really will help the user or the person who ordered the phase one, will help that user evaluate what the next steps in the process might involve. So the opinion by the environmental professional is very important. Now, the ASTM standard and AAI require that the report include very specific and exact statements to be used in documenting the opinion, and that language really comes in one of two options. The first bullet here, being the situation where no recognized environmental conditions were identified, and the second statement is in the situation where recognized environmental conditions are identified. So it's very important that one of these two statements verbatim be included in the report. The environmental professional should not deviate from this language as it is required by the AAI regulation and the ASTM standard. And it's also important to note that these statements should not use the name of the environmental firm. It really is the environmental professional who signs and certifies the report. I mentioned significant data gaps. The report requires the identification of any significant data gaps. And you know, a data gap really may result from the incompleteness in any one of the activities required by the standard, such as the inability to conduct a site visit. Perhaps there was an inability to interview, you know, a key owner or occupant or regulatory officials. You know, the environmental professional must identify and document those data gaps that affect his or her ability to identify environmental conditions and draw conclusions about the assessment. You know, just some examples. For instance, if the site history, if you know that the site was used for an industrial purpose for, you know, 100 years, but you only have interview or document, historical document information that covers 10 of those 100 years, that's a pretty significant data gap of 90 years that you don't know what's going on. Perhaps you weren't able to perform the site visit for some key reason. That would be a significant data gap. So those data gaps need to be documented in the report. And then lastly, with respect to the qualifications, AI regulation ASTM requires that the exact language here shown up in the first two bullets be included in the report, and again should not deviate from these statements. So essentially, these are indicating that the environmental professional overseeing the inquiry, you know, meets the definition of an environmental professional as defined in 312.10. And that person has the specific qualifications, education, training, and experience to develop and you know develop conclusions or opinions regarding that. So again, these are very specific statements that need to be included in the report. As I said, the you know the format of the report, the regulation, the AI regulation does not require a specific format or structure or length. It only requires that a written report is prepared. However, the ASTM standard in Appendix X5 does actually provide a suggested format, which I've laid out here on the next couple slides. And this is largely, to be honest with you, what is used and followed by environmental professionals in the industry. Most environmental professionals sort of stick to this format. It's you know it's compliant. It provides a thorough you know assessment of the different you know stages of the inquiry as well as the conclusion findings and conclusions and opinion. So you know if the user of a phase one, including a grantee or prospective property owner, is ever going to defend themselves down the road, for example, in proving one of the CERCLA liability defenses, they should have a comprehensive report that documents what was done and what was found. The user really needs to demonstrate that they actually performed AAI in compliance with the regulations and appropriate standards. And the ASTM suggested report format really accomplishes this. So I'm not going to go through each of the sections here, but you get the gist, you know, executive summary, introduction, site reconnaissance, you know, what was found during the site visit, what did the records reviews result in, interviews, non-scope services, which we'll talk about next here, findings and opinions, conclusions, and then those environmental professional statements, as well as references and appendices. You know, a lot of you really should see that environmental database report, figures, aerial photographs, sandborne maps in the appendices of any decent quality phase one report. I know I've mentioned non-scope considerations a few times now, and these are activities that, while not required as part of a phase one, they may be helpful in filling data gaps and evaluating other environmental risks associated with the property. In section 13, Appendix X6 and Appendix X6 of the ASTM standard provide a thorough list and description of the different types of non-scope considerations. And this slide really just illustrates several of the more common ones. You know, sometimes these activities are done as part of a phase one. They don't need to be. Sometimes they are. Other times they're included as part of a phase two, or oftentimes they're just conducted as separate activities and included something, including some of those commonly done at brownfield sites, such as lead-based paint surveys, asbestos surveys, radon testing, and that sort of thing, typically associated with older buildings and older properties. One important point I should make here is non-scope considerations also include substances that are not currently defined as hazardous substances, including some emergent contaminants like PFAS, unless or until such substances are classified as a CERCLA hazardous substance. So again, PFAS being a prime example. Though PFAS substances are not yet defined as CERCLA hazardous substances, given their recent attention and potential risk to human health, you'll see more and more phase ones, including information about the presence or likely presence of PFAS, particularly if the subject property had anything to do with manufacturing of, nonstick cookware, water-repellent clothing, stain-resistant fabrics, some firefighting foams, and products that generally resist grease and oil. So now you've got your your phase one report, and but as a user of a phase one report, as a grantee, you need to understand what that report means and what the next steps in the process are. And this slide really just highlights sort of the three most common outcomes of a phase one report. The first outcome being that no recognized environmental conditions were identified and that the data are complete. In this case, typically, no further assessment, investigation, or study would be needed. The second outcome being that significant data gaps were identified by the environmental professional. As I said, such as missing periods of history, inability to perform certain interviews. In this case, additional phase one activities may be prudent, such as performing those additional interviews or gathering more data, or there may be a need to just move directly to a phase two ESA. And the last outcome really being that wrecks have been identified and there is a need for additional investigation as part of a phase two. So in this case, you would move directly to a phase two. The next two slides here really pertain specifically to brownfields grantees who have phase ones conducted with grant funding. The environmental professional will typically submit a draft report for review by the grant manager, and the grant manager should take advantage of this opportunity to ensure that the report is accurate and meets the needs of the brownfields program for that community. Once that report is approved, it will become, an important and permanent record and will be used for future decision-making purposes. So it's critical and crucial that you get a good and compliant phase one report. The next slide here, there's a link here to the EPA Brownfield site. This is a checklist. It's a very simple checklist so that if you are procuring a phase one as part of a Brownfields grant, this is a checklist that the grant manager should complete to ensure that, in fact, that assessment was done in accordance with the all appropriate inquiry. And again, you can get this off the EPA's AAI website. Here, this is an interesting slide about some of the common problems that you see in poorly written phase one reports. Again, if you're going to be reviewing a phase one report, you really want to be on the lookout for these things. You're spending good money to on the assessment, and the last thing you want is to have issues with the quality or be left with a report that is honestly not going to hold up to scrutiny or isn't compliant with AAI or ASTM. And it's important to point out that a phase one is usually the basis for planning and scoping out a phase two, including where to take samples, what types of samples to take. So if the phase one is flawed, it could really guide your phase two in the wrong direction and significantly impact future investigation activities. If you're seeing any of these types of errors, be it, missing environmental professional declarations, an expired shelf life, an opinion that's vague or doesn't discuss the appropriateness of additional investigations, call your consultant or your contractor on them. Ask for clarification, have them fix the problems. It's important to point this out. You want to make sure that your report is going to be compliant and useful for the future. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over the next few slides here and leave another a minute or two for some questions. But the last several slides here point out some of the key differences between the old ASTM standard in 2013 versus the newer one in 2021. The overall sort of conclusion here is while there were some key changes in the 2021, they mostly related to instructions and clarifications around some of the key terms, some of the required search, site research and reconnaissance, as well as some additional information on emerging contaminants. The overall gist is that, they didn't change the overall importance or the sort of the conclusions of the standard itself. So I'm going to skip on to the last slide here and just leave you with a few helpful resources and links. This will provide you some additional information on the EPA Brownfields program, details on the AAI requirement and phase one ESAs, as well as some additional mapping and data sources that could be helpful to you as you're performing or reviewing or otherwise embarking on or interested in phase ones. So thanks for joining us. And Jean, do we have a couple minutes for questions or did I use all our time?
I think if it's okay with the audience, I'll take just two or three questions right now. And I did place a link in the meeting chat for everyone. So for those who cannot stay on the line, please know I did put a link back to the seminar homepage where you can download these slides, access these links, and then also open up the seminar feedback form to share your thoughts on our session and get a certificate. So let's jump right into these questions. Kevin, this first one is for you. Just for clarification, the user-provided information that is required by the rule is not the same thing as what falls under the quote interview requirement that must be updated within 180 days of purchase. They say, Kevin, as you explained the quote interview requirements, the user provided info seems to be separate. And we often debate with consultants about whether or not this user questionnaire needs to be updated within the 180 days or not.
Yeah, no, good point. I could go back to the slide, but there were, four pieces of information about the purchase price of the property, reasonably known ascertainable information. That, yes, there is a separate user provided information section. I don't know, maybe Patricia can speak to this. I'm not sure whether that falls within the 180 day requirement or not. And Patricia, maybe you can expand on that.
Yes, the interviews is one of the things that needs to be completed within the 180 days. So the interviews have to be completed within 180 days or the 180 days prior to the acquisition date, or they have to be updated. The interviews have to be updated within 180 days prior to.
And that includes the user provided information, correct?
Well, interviews are user. Not necessarily. The interviews are with the current owner operator. Nope, they're different. The user provided information is different than the interviews of the current and past owners. Sorry.
Yeah, I think that's what the questioner was getting at.
Saying, yeah. The user provided information is different. That's not necessarily included in the 180 days.
Okay. Can an EDR report capture the environmental cleanup liens?
It depends. Yeah, I know that there are commercial firms out there, Lightbox EDR being one of them, that is trying to capture that information about environmental cleanup liens a little bit more than they have in the past. I can't speak to all of the firms and the thoroughness of that search, but I do know that is something that some of these firms are trying to capture in their searches.
Okay.
Yeah, I would be careful with that because the liens are recorded in at the local level, local lands records. So EDR may have that you can order one from from one of the commercial firms, but make sure that you know where they're going to look for them and how thorough it, and it's usually an extra request. It's not included in the normal request.
Right.
Are project officers from EPA required to review the phase one and phase two reports, or is it assumed that the environmental professional is complying with all of the correct ESA requirements when writing these reports?
Project officers should make sure that the checklist is completed and provided by the grantee, not necessarily the AAR report itself. But the checklist needs to be provided, and that documentation must be provided to the project officer.
Okay, two quick questions. I think, Patricia, this one might be for you. On slide 18, it stated that grants provided to states and tribes are not subject to CERCLA 104K. So, brownfields assessments conducted by these entities do not have to be conducted in compliance with AAI. They wondered, getting back to the quiz questions we were asking, maybe it's not a true or false. Specifically, if it's a state or tribe that's recipient of the grant, then those rules don't apply to them.
Well, remember, this is after, let's see. This is true that if a state or tribe is doing an all appropriate inquiry, this is not a state or tribe who's applying for a 104K grant. If a state or tribe applies for a 104K cleanup grant, they have to show that they are not the liable party and they have to do AAI. If a state or tribe is using their 128A funding to conduct an assessment, they don't have to comply with the 104K, but just remember the 104K requirements for AAI. But just remember, any assessment that's done and it's not in compliance with AAI, that assessment cannot be used to establish anybody's liability protection.
All right. And last question. Does EPA keep copies of the phase one reports? Is there a database where they can, or prospective buyers can access these things? Or essentially, are the phase ones sort of starting from scratch if they weren't involved when it was done initially?
Phase ones are not collected by EPA. They are solely owned by the prospective purchaser, and it only can be disclosed to other purchasers if the prospective purchaser for whom ordered, paid for, conducted the AAI makes them available.
All right. Well, I think in the interest of time, since we're a few minutes past 4 o'clock, we'll go ahead and do our closeout procedures. But Kevin or Patricia, any final statements to leave the audience with before I walk through those reminders?
Nope, I'm all set. Thanks everyone for your patience.
Yes, thank you.
All right, excellent. Well, let me just walk through a few quick final reminders today, and then we'll go ahead and close out our live broadcast. I want to thank everybody for staying on just a few extra seconds or a few extra moments as we close things out today. So, just as we pointed out in the beginning of the session, remember there is a unique seminar homepage. I include that URL in the chat earlier. It's also the same place where you went to check in. It's the same place I'll point you to if you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, the hyperlinks that were discussed, as well as if you'd like to access the feedback form for today's session to request a certificate. So, that URL is shown in red on this slide, which will be available from today forward. If you would like to have a participation certificate, please make sure you fill out the online feedback form on the seminar homepage. Again, URL is shown in red. When you fill out that feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire session. And then when you submit your feedback, you'll then immediately have access to a certificate that you can download or print out for your own records. If you happen to host a viewing party at your location and had other individuals watch from your location, please send them that link to the seminar homepage. They can fill out the feedback form on their own and get their own certificate, even though they may not have registered on their own and simply joined through your connection. So we encourage you to send that to anyone who shared or watched from your location. As noted, the seminar materials are available online. Contact information for our speakers and organizers also posted there, and there's also that link to the feedback form. If you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of today's webinar, right about now in that archive above my head in the upper right, there'll be a button that'll take you to that seminar feedback form so you can share your thoughts based on the replay and still get a certificate based up of watching the archive. We usually take about a week or so before we post the archive, so please watch for an email from us in about 1 week or so with the link to access the recorded version, and you're welcome to share that with other environmental professionals who would enjoy watching today's session. So with that, I want to thank the over 200 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast, along with our presenters and organizers who helped make today's session possible and all the support staff on in the background. I hope that you all found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll join us on a future Clue in the Internet seminar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live session. Thanks so very much for joining us.